and click donate to join the circle today.
Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Friends, this is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. And that song never gets old. We hear it week after week here, and I always love it. So my wonderful co-host, Jim Lafferty, is still out traveling the world, but he will be back with us soon around August. But in the meantime, we've got another great show lined up for you today. First, I'll be speaking with attorney Anthony Cornerans about the societal challenges of protecting our elders as California's population aged 60 plus is growing faster than any other group. Then we'll be joined by attorneys Jen Ganada and Idalmos Viquero to discuss their work on the front lines of environmental and climate justice and about the status of the environmental justice movement locally and nationally. So please stay tuned for that. And very briefly, I want to take 30 seconds to say thank you to KPFK, our beloved host station, and remind you that it's summer fun drive time. KPFK is turning 65 this year, and during that time, it's provided generation after generation with alternative voices, culture, and community. The staff and volunteers work wonders on a shoestring budget, but even a shoestring budget doesn't grow on trees, especially when KPFK does not sell ads to Wall Street. So as a listener-sponsored station, it's on us to keep KPFK vibrant, independent, and loud. So please check out kpfk.org and make your pledge as you're listening, please, and tell them the Lawyers Guild Show sent you. Okay, enough said. Let's move on to our first segment. Yesterday, California Senator Bill Dodd announced a resolution designated June as Elder and Dependent Adult Abuse Awareness Month. That coincides with World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which was established in 2006 by the United Nations to raise awareness of the cultural, social, economic, and demographic processes affecting elder abuse and neglect. And there's been no better time than the present to grapple with those issues. According to the Public Policy Institute of California, our population of people aged 60 and older is growing faster than any other age group, largely due to the baby boomers. And it's not just California, though. A UN World Population Report shows a similar trend, and it predicts that by 2050, worldwide, the number of people over 65 will be double the number of children under age 5. So how will these shifts impact our communities and our families? What about the labor force, the economy, housing, and healthcare? Are there changes we should be making to better protect the rights and well-being of our elders now and in the future, those who are the most dependent and vulnerable to physical, emotional, and financial abuse? Well, to talk to us about this subject today, I'm so happy to introduce our first guest, Anthony Cornerans. Anthony has been practicing law for over 38 years and has a substantial track record performing public interest and civil rights work, and that includes representing clients in matters involving age discrimination and elder abuse. Anthony Cornerans, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you.
So let's start with the topic of baby boomers. The U.S. Census Bureau defines baby boomers as people born between 1946 and 1964, meaning they're now between roughly 60 and 78. By 2030, older adults are expected to comprise a quarter of California's population. Has this generational shift changed the nature of legal services that you're called upon to provide? And if so, what kinds of changes have you been seeing?
Yes, definitely yes. And because I'm a litigator who is sort of transforming himself into someone who's trying to prevent litigation before it happens, I'm seeing an increased focus on age discrimination in the workplace and financial elder abuse. There are many other changes, but that's sort of my perspective on it. Especially financial elder abuse. I'm really seeing a rise in that, and it's taking all shapes and forms, things that I couldn't have imagined a few years ago. We'll say it that way.
So California's Master Plan on Aging identifies 5 goals that the state hopes to accomplish by 2030. They include safe housing, healthcare, inclusion and equity without isolation, caregiving that works, and affordable aging. I have a feeling you have some opinions on this subject. Can you share some of the challenges that you predict the state will encounter in achieving these goals?
Sure. The first thing I'd like to do is to refer everybody listening, if they're interested, to mpa.aging.ca.gov/. It's an incredible roadmap because it's succinct. It's not particularly doctrinal. They really seem to be trying to summarize the issues and really the long-term strategic planning of the state to address those issues. I do believe, however, that there's only so much the state can do in isolation. The people who would try to attempt to help elders and elders themselves need to step up and do their own things. And part of the problem, as I see it, and I've seen it, I'm not going to give specific examples because I can't, obviously, but I've seen it many times, many elderly people, and I say this with respect, have some form of diminished capacity, whether it be cognitive, social, or other form of challenge that perhaps younger people don't have. There are definitely cultural and generational differences that exacerbate problems and misunderstandings. And those in turn, and this is why I mentioned the URL, lead to isolation, and isolation in turn leads to abuse, including potentially self-abuse to some extent, but certainly abuse by others. And you can become isolated, obviously, if your spouse has passed, your friends have passed or moved away, you have impaired mobility, you withdraw inward because you become depressed or detached. You think the world has passed you by and you're just kind of biding time until you join your friends who've past, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you don't engage in the world as much, or the elder doesn't engage in the world as much. And what exacerbates that or contributes to that, what I've seen, and it's actually in the Master Plan for Aging, are technological divides. There's a lack of desire or ability to use the internet. There are vision and hearing issues regarding phones. There's a lack of adaptation to change technologies, and there's always the problem that everybody has, which is finances, right? I mean, and even if you have a lot of money as an older person, maybe you don't know how to access it anymore. Maybe it's in your house. And sadly, I've noticed a lot of have and have not dynamics. The baby boomers came up at a time when it was relatively easy to buy a house. 10% down payment, lower middle income, you could buy a house, make your mortgage payments. And now elderly people are sitting on these houses worth $1 million or more with literally no loans on them, with really low property taxes due to Prop 13. And they don't really know what to do, but others look at that and say, now, how did that person get this? And why don't I have it? And how do I get my share? And that's sort of a negative way of looking at things, but some people do look at things that way. Then other people don't come into it with a sense of evil, but they're like, look, I'm on the street. I need to live somewhere. I'm going to live somewhere. I'm going to take care of this elderly person, perhaps in exchange for room and board. But then there's a feeling of entitlement. Oh, wait a minute. Why does that person have all of this? Why do I have to listen to their harangues, their issues? Why do I have to deal with their dementia? I need to get rewarded for what I'm going through and what I'm putting up with. And since their family is gone, since their friends are gone, I'm going to get everything. I do see that dynamic at work in many ways. And people don't always start out with that intention, but I've seen things develop that way. So I think, and also, of course, there's savings and other personal property. Okay, grab some money, accept a gift. Perhaps the elderly person finally has someone to talk to and they want to keep that person, so they start giving them things. The recipient gets used to receiving things, and then an unhealthy dynamic can be created. So what the state talks about, what they've recognized, is that safe housing is very important in terms of accessibility, in terms of the potential for community living, and in terms of support structures for elderly people. Because what I see is accessibility issues. I see hoarding. I see deferred maintenance or no maintenance. And I see people self-isolating in their homes because they're afraid to go out. And they did not create support structures. And as a result of that, they become unduly dependent on the people who do pop in. And I, from time to time, have gotten to know elderly people, and within a very short period of time, I'm being offered all sorts of things, not because I've asked. And of course, I always say no, but I can understand that some people don't want to say no. And so there's a power dynamic, and it's a very odd one, because on the one hand, the elderly person, and I'm not talking about all our elderly people, so please don't be offended. And I'm a boomer, so I can probably say it this way, but some elderly people, as they age in place, perhaps they hit 90 or 95 or 100, you know, there's dementia, there's impaired health, so there's a dependency. So they become more like the child, and the caregiver becomes more like the adult. So it creates a really strange dichotomy, because the caregiver is perhaps living there and needs that roof over their head, or needs the money on the one hand, but on the other hand, they have all the power, but on the other hand, they don't have any power because they can be fired at any time, theoretically. So it's a really unhealthy dynamic that can develop. So you have this role reversal with the caregiver as opposed to a family member, but not all family members necessarily behave the right way either. So the roles can become ambiguous. And obviously there are generational issues, cultural issues, and what might seem appropriate to an elder may not be appropriate to a caregiver. Maybe certain words, phrases are used that somebody in their 20s or 30s would not appreciate, whereas somebody in their 60s, 70s, or 80s, they don't think about it. That's just how they grew up. That's how they talk. So there are all sorts of challenges and issues. So those are some of the problems that I've seen. And if you ask me later, I can talk to you about some of the things I would recommend to try to counteract that.
Yes, definitely. I will hold you to that. Okay. Because there are a lot of issues, and I'm pretty sure that listeners have at least experienced a little bit of what you're talking about, because I think it does resonate with, you know, almost all of us know somebody who's aging, or we're aging ourselves. I mean, we are aging ourselves, right?
So, oh, definitely, and, definitely.
Yes. So, but I did want to ask you one more question before we get to the positives, the recommendations, and what people can do. I did want to just flag an issue that I ran across in the New York Times. There was an article called "Substance Abuse is Climbing Among Seniors" by a reporter named Paula San, who quotes a Stanford psychologist as saying, quote, "Aging boomers still use drugs far more than their parents did, and the field wasn't ready for that." What legal implications, as far as that you've seen in you know, the legal profession, what legal implications might there be in navigating substance abuse issues alongside the challenges of aging adults and people with disabilities?
People, as a lawyer, I need to make sure that my clients have sufficient capacity to understand the advice that I'm giving them and to make informed decisions. And obviously substance abuse can get in the way of that. And of course, it depends on how bad it is and how frequent it is. And, you know, that can range from all sorts. It can basically range. But there's a difference between capacity to make decisions and impaired capacity. For example, two glasses of wine, you drive, maybe you're buzzed, but it doesn't mean you're incapacitated for the rest of your life. So obviously that, and we can go on for days about that, but I have to be very careful when dealing with clients to be really patient with them, to talk them through issues, to get them at a time when they can think about it, to repeat it over and over and over again, to make sure they understand, have them repeat it to me. But that's my job as a professional, informed consent. Where I see it as being a real problem is when somebody has impaired cognition or physical symptoms or failure to thrive due to or exacerbated by substance abuse, they become increasingly dependent and therefore susceptible to financial elder abuse. And we have pretty good laws in California that prohibit financial elder abuse, but there's a glut of complaints. It's happening all over the place, and we need more lawyers who will step up and do that kind of work. There are some lawyers who are doing it, who do it very well, but we need so many more. So when you have substance abuse on top of it, and you have caregivers or others taking advantage of someone who's impaired, it just makes for a disaster. So that's as much as I can say about it now without burning the next 5 hours of your time.
Right,
which I know
right.
I can't
no,
do.
I appreciate that I'm throwing you questions that we could definitely spend days on. And for listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Pacifica's KPFK 90.7 FM. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your host, Maria Hall. I've been speaking with attorney Anthony Cornerance about how we can better protect our elders as those 60 plus become the largest segment of our population. And just a quick reminder that it's KPFK's pledge drive, fund drive time. So please make your pledge at kpfk.org while you're listening. $5, $50, $500, whatever you can afford, even $1, truly. Every bit counts. Okay, so Anthony, let's get back to your question then of what kind of help is available. There are, I mean, sometimes when I've looked at the websites on this, there's almost too much information, but it's really great and inspiring to see that there really is a lot, there are a lot of resources. So what kind of help is available for seniors who may be experiencing abuse, whether it be physical, emotional, financial, or neglect?
Well, I would say the first line of defense is to plan ahead and build a support structure. And you can do it as a senior, even when you're experiencing what you just described. So reach out to your family. Try not to alienate them. Try not to let them alienate themselves from you. Don't be afraid to talk to your family, even distant relatives. You might have, there might be some who you need to be afraid of, but you have to, as a senior, just figure it out. Use your own mind. Take responsibility. Reach out to your friends. If you have a church or a temple or some other organization that you're affiliated with, reach out to them. Be a part of community organizations. Volunteer. Reach out to your healthcare providers. Reach out to agencies. But agencies are probably, obviously they have a role, but that's after things are really gotten bad. Reach out to private attorneys. And if you have the resources, or even if you think you don't, consider hiring a professional fiduciary to manage your affairs. Because what happens is, it's like anything, there's neglect. You wait until you're, I don't know, your engine, you've blown out your engine on the Harbor Freeway before you change the oil. That's a bad metaphor, but you get my point. Plan ahead if you can. And know that you have power. Know that you have power no matter what. Second line of defense, sort of related to the first, do estate planning. Look into organizational support for in-home living. A lot of elderly people, you know, they've lived in their home. They raised their family there. They had life experiences there. Maybe their spouse died in the home. I mean, all sorts of things happen. Okay. They don't want to leave. But you have to be willing to leave and willing to be flexible if that's what's better. I'm not telling anybody what to do one way or another, but at least think about it. Inertia is the worst thing physically, mentally, and legally for anybody. Volunteer outside of the home, engage with the community, and as I said, consider alternative housing. Now, your question was basically, if you think you are being abused, and you don't have anybody else to reach out to, I'm adding that to your question, contact the LA County Elder and Dependent Abuse Hotline, 1-877-477-3646. It is staffed 24/7 by County Adult Protect Services. And you can also, if you use the internet, go online and report it. And that's ad.lacounty.gov/adult-protective-services. So you can report it in that way, and they will look into it. And look, please understand that the person or people who you think you have no protection from, you actually do have protection from, because you have to reach out. And don't make excuses, okay? At this point, you're not 27 years old and you're making excuse for a bad relationship, and you can bounce back. Okay, you're 67 or you're 77 or you're 87. You don't have as much ability to protect yourself at this point. You really don't. And you have more to lose given what you have in relation to perhaps what your abuser has. You don't need to judge people. You don't need to be afraid, but you do need to be concerned, and you need to act on your concern. So reach out, please. And government will help, or call a good legal services entity. For example, Betsedic Legal Services in LA, or the Elder Law and Disability Rights Center in Orange County. Just reach out, or even call a friend. If you volunteered in the past, call somebody higher up in that organization, but be mindful, because sometimes people are in those organizations, and let's just say one thing they do is befriend elderly people and then wind up being written into their estate plans. That can happen from time to time. So I'm just saying, ultimately, if you take responsibility, even if you're tired, even if you're depressed, even if you're feeling sick, even if you're feeling despondent, know that it can always be better if you make it better. And then reach out to the resources that are available to you. And LA also has an aging and disabilities department. You can contact them and find out information about transportation, meals, healthcare, community centers, caregiver support, respite care for caregivers, and even referrals to legal assistance if you need it. But act sooner rather than later. And every once in a while, somebody might come in and rescue you, just because you need it, but you can't count on that. You need to let people know you're there.
Yes, thank you for all of that. And what about some other resources can you share, just so that people can have some help getting through the challenges of aging and caregiving? And what other sort of best practices might you recommend?
Have friends who you stay in communication with. I think that's the most important best practice. So even if your friend has moved out of town, because look, people move, life changes, and people get busy. Reach out, pick up the phone and call. And if you're not feeling well, or if you think something bad is happening, don't deny. Don't say, yeah, I'm okay. You know, say, I don't feel comfortable with what's happening in my home. And if that friend won't help, call another friend. And if nothing, again, call the state of California. If you're outside of LA County, you can even call 833-401-0832. Or call family, call somebody. Most people do have networks of people who they can talk to. They just don't know about it. Perhaps they're confused. Again, perhaps they're despondent. Perhaps they don't think it's going to do any good. It will do some good, because without getting too deeply into the spiritual realm, nobody wants to go out with chaos and dissension and talking to lawyers 24/7. Okay, that's not the way to spend the last years of your life. You want some peace. You want some stability. You don't have to have a lot of money, but you want peace and stability. So please reach out. There are all sorts of resources available. And again, estate planning, communal living, potentially volunteering outside of the home, staying in contact with your friends, giving your estate plan, by the way, to somebody other than a lawyer. Don't do like a little statutory form will and shove it in a safe deposit box. under your bed that your caregiver has access to, because you'll potentially find that it got changed, or your heirs will potentially find that they're no longer the heirs, that somebody else are the heirs. But don't live in fear. Just be proactive about it. You've lived your whole life, right? You've gotten up to age X, Y, or Z, and you're going to keep living, but only if you live as best as you permit yourself to live. So I just say, feel your power, take your power, and just like the theme song, right? But yeah, you can do it in place. And by the way, if you're impaired, okay, if you're on too much medication, reach out, get some help.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you have to get off of it. You can still have control, but you only have control if you exert that control. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing I can say.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, not to make everything about KPFK's fund drive, but I have to say that I know a lot of active people with KPFK who have volunteered through that are all ages. So it's like, that's just one example that how it connects people, because you know, whether they're volunteering for one of the old sales, like the garage rummage sales that KPFK has had, or at events, or even on the listener station board. I mean, it's all about, you know, we're all a community. We're all neighbors. We should all be checking on one another. We can all do a lot, whether you're young or older. To both for yourself, for your family, and for our whole community. So I think it's just great that, you know, that we've had you here today to talk about these issues. It is just going to become more and more, and we do see it on every level, worldwide, you know, to statewide, to locally, our city. And I think it's a great topic, because it is something we can all participate in directly and help people with. So
right,
Anthony,
and just,
go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, well, one other thing, just know that you're not alone. Okay, what I see is a lot of people feel like they're alone. They feel a little bit ashamed that they need that kind of help. Yeah. That's why I really recommend the website, the Master Plan for Aging website that I gave at the beginning of this broadcast. Go on there and see that. And by the way, if you don't have a computer, call somebody and say, you know, come over and show me this website. I'm serious about this. Have
That's
them walk
so
you through
true.
It. Yeah. Right. And then you'll say, oh my gosh, yeah, I'm one of thousands of people. I'm not alone. These are normal challenges. Mm-hmm. Seriously, people are so hard on themselves when they have diminished capacity. Mm-hmm. They really are. And if you're hard on yourself, you will let other people be hard on you. Learn mm-hmm. what other people are going through, learn what the state is trying to do, and then help those around you, your community, to help you, to help yourself. It's real basic stuff, but it's fundamental to this situation. It's the best way to combat it.
Yes, thank you so much. Attorney Anthony Cornerans, thank you for shedding light on all of those issues for us, all about Elder and Dependent Adult Abuse Awareness Month, but we shouldn't have to wait for June in order to talk about these things. It's something we should be thinking about every day. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. We'll see you soon. We'll talk. We'll do another one talking about age discrimination coming up. So we'll invite you back.
Sounds
for
good.
That.
Sounds good. All right.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Well, in just a moment, we'll be joined by environmental justice attorneys Jen Ganada and Idalmas Vaquero to discuss the status of environmental and climate justice movements locally and nationally. But first, just a quick reminder that it's KPFK's fund drive time. KPFK works miracles on a shoestring budget. It leverages the donations from all of us listeners. I'm a listener too, by the way, along with thousands of volunteer hours from producers, hosts, and others. And KPFK provides a constant 24-hour streaming service to bring us stories that are directly relevant to us and our communities, and without a streaming price. I mean, it's free. And KPFK also introduces us to other cultures and music. It offers fresh perspectives that we don't hear on the mainstream news. And how does KPFK do it? How does it stay independent? Well, just like everything else, follow the money. The money comes from listeners. So that's how we stay free and independent. KPFK doesn't take donations or sell ads to big corporate powers. And that's why, because we're funded by you and by me. So all you have to do is go quickly to www.kpfk.org and click the Fund Drive link. You can pitch in $5, $50, $500, whatever you happen to be able to afford right now. And that is the magic of it. It's the habit of giving. It's the habit of putting a little bit into that big pot of shoestring budget that each one of us, some of us can give a little more, some of us a little less, but it all goes towards the cause. And it really is our labor of love. So let's keep that flowing. www.kpfk.org. And if you don't want to do the web thing, you can just call 818-985-5735. All right. Well, let's go right back into the program, segment two. If you're just tuning in, I'm Maria Hall, and this is the Lawyers Guild Show. We now turn to a topic near and dear to my heart. Today, June 5th, is World Environment Day, which the United Nations established back in 1972 to remind us that we all, each one of us, must take responsibility and take action to fight for the health and welfare of our beautiful planet Earth. So our next two guests, attorneys Jen Ganada and Idalmis Vaquero, are doing just that and more. They're using their brilliant strategic legal minds to fight for the health of our land, air, water, and climate, yes, but they are also doing so through a lens of social justice, arm in arm with communities who are bearing the worst consequences of contamination, climate change, and pollution to change the underlying policies that got us here. Jen Ganada is the Legal Department Co-Director at Communities for a Better Environment, also known as CBE. Before law school, Jen worked as a CBE youth organizer. And in addition to her environmental justice work, Jen has also championed the rights of tenants, working at both Eviction Defense Network and Inner City Law Center. Like Jen, attorney Idalmis Vaquero also worked before law school as a youth organizer at CBE. And upon graduating, became an attorney there. Idalmis currently works as an attorney and senior policy analyst for Just Solutions, a national organization that partners with communities disproportionately impacted by climate change to turn their priorities into policies and laws. And full disclosure, I'm also a proud alum of CBE. Woohoo! Go HP, Huntington Park. Okay, welcome to the show, Jen and Idalmis.
Hi.
All right, so let's jump on in, and I'll start with attorney Jen Ganada. In broad strokes, tell our listeners, what exactly is environmental justice?
There are quite a bit of different definitions for environmental justice. I think that in its most basic form, essentially, it's everyone has the right to clean air, clean water, clean soil. But I think when we're talking about environmental justice, it's also acknowledging that there are actually quite a bit of communities that don't have the right to that. So I think there's like acknowledgement of having to right that harm. And so making sure those communities have the right to clean water, clean air, and clean soil.
All right. And attorney Idalmis Vaquero, do you have anything to add to that? And can you also define the term climate justice?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Related to environmental justice, climate justice is a recognition that the disproportionate impacts of climate change are on low-income communities and communities of color, and specifically those that have not actually had the most responsibility and that have caused the harm of climate change. And so that's what we say when we talk about climate justice. And I think relatedly, you know, the environmental justice and climate justice movements are really rooted in a just transition framework of stopping the bad and building the good. And building the good basically is rooted in deep democracy of communities and ensuring that there's a regenerative economy that actually benefits people and the environment that we live in.
Ah, nicely said. So how does environmental and climate justice play out in your day-to-day work as lawyers? Let's start with Jen Ganata. What are some of your current projects at Communities for a Better Environment?
We have a bunch of different, different projects. So CBE actually has offices in East Oakland, Richmond, Southeast LA, and Wilmington. And all four of those communities have pretty active campaigns. The ones that are local in the LA area, I'd say the one that has been in the press quite a bit is the Standing Together Against Neighborhood Drilling in Los Angeles, the Stand LA. CBE is one of the co-founding partners of that. And really that is to stop neighborhood drilling in Los Angeles. And there is like a partner campaign that's happening in the county. I focus on a lot of the work in Southeast LA and ongoing issues. And Edel Mies knows this, is that we're still working on the community cleanup Beckside. So there have been multiple organizations working on this. The other community organization, East Arrows Communities for Environmental Justice, has been pretty much working with the different community members along with CBE to make sure that a community cleanup around the Exide facility occurs. What's really challenging right now is not knowing what the future holds for that, given that the state budget is kind of in crisis. I think a lot of it requires also thinking about what are the relationships with the federal government. Will the federal government come in and step in and put the Exide site on the national priorities list? But then what happens to the ongoing community cleanup that happens? And kind of related to that, so a lot of the work, I mean, Marie, you know this, and working in Southeast LA is focusing on incompatible land uses, where there are communities of color, disadvantaged communities being impacted by multiple sources of pollution. One of those instances is actually in unincorporated county, Florence Firestone Walnut Park. CBE has been working for quite some time, since 2016, on just the remediation of the land that used to be a metal recycler. We have worked with the county to pass the Green Zones Ordinance, which we were able to pass. However, the folks who own the metal recycler ended up selling that land to U-Haul, and U-Haul then put in an application before the Green Zones Ordinance was put in place. And so for folks who aren't familiar with the LA County's Green Zones Ordinance, it was supposed to prohibit specific types of uses that are up against communities, basically the communities that we're working with. And so there is an ongoing issue with that. Actually, Edel Mies has been helping us too, of kind of writing comments to the federal government and trying to change how the federal government thinks about community cleanup for lead levels, because in the federal scheme, like, they actually have, before any corrective action happens, it's higher than in the state. So the state level where something is considered an exceedance, like for lead, for instance, it's 80 parts per million. In the federal government, it just recently changed to 200 parts per million, and 100 parts per million in some other places. And that's just for lead. And like, it's not also like a lot of things that have been happening around the U-Haul site. The proposed U-Haul site is, you know, elevated levels of arsenic, which is also harmful to your health. Also, thinking about, I think it's just different chemicals that are still remain in the ground, and making sure that it's not being impacted by the development of the project. So, I mean, I think what's interesting about thinking about land use in this way, particularly where we are seeing so many calls to action to curbing the California Environmental Quality Act, and just making sure that we're building housing. And I want to say, first and foremost, I think EJ Communities, specifically CBE, like, we are very concerned and really hopeful that we're going to get good, affordable housing, deeply affordable housing. That's what we want. However, we don't want to cut corners when we do that. We want to make sure that these developments that are coming to communities are actually being built, going back to what Ilme said, like, through community input. So residents are able to say what's happening in their community, because for us, community planning and community-led decision-making is so important to environmental justice. Like, that's how you understand what's happening on the ground. How do you build projects that actually impact the community and are helpful for the community? So I'd say we have a lot of different things that are really just intersecting, right? Because we know that we need good, resilient housing for the future because we are in the middle of a climate crisis. But we also know that there's an affordability crisis. So we're also thinking about, like, what are the ways to make sure that the communities we're working in get to remain the communities they've been organizing around and not get pushed out? So, like, I think there are so many issues there. And that's just, like, one part of the work, because obviously we are still working to stop the fossil fuel industry, and we are working to move things like just infrastructure that's not relying on things that are going to continue to harm the planet and harm our communities. It's an exciting time to do this type of work, but it's also at the same time, like, you know, you have, like, there's a time crunch. Like, we are also kind of, you know, in the middle of it. Like, it's not like, when is it going to happen? We are experiencing all these problems now. Like, it's not like a theoretical thing anymore.
Wow. So yes, in some ways, even though in the past people didn't realize how critical it was, so it's like you had to explain and justify your existence. Now it's like, okay, it's happening. I may not need to justify so much, but now how do we actually fix it or make it more sustainable? Well, Edalmas, I wanted to give you a chance to chime in on that. What are some of the current projects you're working on with Just Solutions and with your other volunteer work?
Yeah, so Just Solutions is a national movement partner organization, and our goal is to broaden and deepen the understanding and the implementation of equitable and effective climate policies and programs to meet the urgency of the climate crisis. So working hand in hand with community partners, and I know we work closely with CBE on some of those things, and other partners at in other states and at the national level. And I would say at the national level, we're focused on a couple of big things coming out of the Biden administration. So first and foremost is the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, also known as a bipartisan infrastructure law. And there's so many programs coming out of these two laws with a lot of different climate policies and programs. But one of the most important ones we're really focused on is the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which is about $27 billion of funding for a variety of different projects. But, a big portion of that is for a competition of a smaller portion of that is for Solar for All, which is basically they're all focused on going towards low-income communities of color and getting solar and renewable energy in communities. And in some ways, making that owned, community-owned by those who have been impacted the most. So a part of our work is to make sure that these programs are built in the most justice-forward way and are centered around what community needs and wants. And then the other part to that, again, a big portion of the Inflation Reduction Act was that a lot of the funding is actually in the form of tax credits. And so a big part of our work is to making sure also that these tax credits that are going to states are actually being tapped in by low-income communities of color, obviously, because what we know is that a lot of low-income folks don't actually carry a lot of tax liability. And so what good are tax credits when a household does not have that liability? So part of our work is to make sure that these credits can be refunded or given back to those households in some way, shape, or form. And then on a broader scale is making sure, like, when it comes to clean energy credits, so the production and manufacturing of clean energy, making sure that these credits are being transparent and there's accountability behind who, you know, how they're managed. And since it's a lot of money going to clean energy companies, so we want to make sure that there's transparency and accountability behind all of that. The other two things I'll note is that we're also very focused around the implementation of Justice 40 and how disadvantaged communities, again, not only are impacted and can benefit from all of the Inflation Reduction Act policies, but really making sure that, you know, how communities are defined is an important way. You know, as some of you may know, race was not accounted for when it came to a community being counted towards Justice 40. And so there's a lot of like gaps in that definition, since we know that environmental justice communities and those most impacted are actually, you can see that on the basis of race in our country. So we're really pushing to make that, figure out a path forward with Justice 40. And lastly, similar to CEQA, but on a national level, the National Environmental Policy Act is also going through some regulatory changes. And so one of the things that we're looking at are the final regulations and how actually for the first time ever, environmental justice is being codified. And so it's a really big step forward. Great news for communities who are using NEPA to address the permitting issues and you know, look at programs in their community, projects in their community that are subject to the NEPA Act. So some of the things in our works.
Wow. It's so much, but I hope people will, even if they don't know what certain things are, like Justice 40, like I hope they'll look them up, because there's so much that you're both doing that it's not easy to explain in a nutshell. And that's why most media, you don't see it on the sound bites of mainstream media. But that's because we have to get in depth here at KPFK. And by the way, this is the Lawyers Guild show that you're listening to. I'm Maria Hall. I am speaking with attorneys Jen Ganada and Idalmis Vaquero about environmental justice. And now I want to switch to the topic of youth, the power of the youth. And you were both youth organizers before law school. So I would love to hear from you both about the importance of youth activism in environmental work today. And of course, kind of, does it keep you going? I imagine that sort of can give you a little bit of a lift when you're otherwise feeling down. Let's start with Jen.
Yeah, I totally actually should have let you know. Like I did the, I became a youth organizer after law school. So after I graduated law school, I came back to LA and I got a job with CDE.
I forgot you were in the East Coast.
I was in the East Coast. And I think, so I feel like, it's very relevant to today. Like we're seeing student protests everywhere, right? Like even locally around a ceasefire and what's going on in Palestine. And I think the importance of that is also like recognizing I've been following it and listening and you know, professors who are interested in who've been like supporting the students. It's because like this is about right now, but also like we are going to have to deal with the consequences of our actions today. And that will impact the youth always, right? And I think when we think about youth organizing in the environmental justice space, like really we're talking about like, what are we thinking about the sustainability of now, but what will our future look like, right? We already, like CBE had a youth program when I got there, but it was only in Southeast LA, and I was able to extend that to Wilmington. And I think the importance there, particularly as we were working about refineries, as we were like starting to see the beginnings of what would then become our issues that we would bring into Stand LA, it was thinking about the youth who had asthma, the youth who were like missing school, and you know, like there really isn't who's accountable to them, you know. And I think having young folks get into a space and advocate for themselves, even like by law, they're not able to vote, I think is very powerful. I think it really does shape the way we think about like our policies now and how it's like, just because you can't vote doesn't mean you don't have a voice in this situation. And like for me, like youth organizing really helps ground like what I'm doing. I think it also helped me, you know, like when I end up doing housing, like I thought about that too. I feel like a lot of the work in housing justice is very related to environmental justice work.
Absolutely. Idalmis, well, actually, let me just clarify for listeners, too, who maybe aren't familiar with the geography of L.A., both Wilmington and Huntington Park are extensions of that Alameda corridor basically from the port to downtown LA and then out to the rest of the country. So we're basically like the artery of goods that are shipped from, you know, the Pacific Ocean. Edalmas, I would love to hear your thoughts on that. What is the importance of youth activism to you?
Yeah, I mean, I owe a lot of where I am and what I'm doing in part to the youth program at CBE, because I was a youth, like a college undergrad, when I first heard about Exide, and then I interned at CBE and just heard about what was going on in my backyard, and living very close to the Exide facility. So that really, I mean, just the amount of information that I came to while at CBE and in those like very formative years have been like what I know not only myself but other youth get from these youth programs. And so it really is a great starting place for a lot of folks to understand what environmental justice is. And it's really great to see you know how folks are have the ability and sort of are trained to get in front of legislators, in front of policymakers, and make their voices heard. And so it's always inspiring to see them. And I agree with everything that Jen said. I'll go with that.
Well, I also love to see, you know, now that I'm getting older, just to see our legal profession becoming more diverse as well, like seeing people from the community actually then going to law school and actually doing the work in the communities that we came from. Like, to me, that's what it's all about. And unfortunately, we are out of time, but I wanted for both of you to briefly let us know if listeners do want to join in the fight to make the world more healthy and sustainable and just, where can they find out more about your work and what you're doing and how they can get involved? So Jen, yeah. Why don't we start?
So I actually was going to do a huge plug. So CBE is one of the is part of a coalition that's called the Campaign for a Health, Safe and Healthy California. And essentially there was a law that got passed, I think in 2022 by Senator Lena Gonzalez, and it was SB 1137. And the whole point of the law was to make sure that no Californians had to endure health hazards from living next to oil wells. And so it was going to ban like having any oil wells within sensitive receptors of 3,200 feet. So obviously big oil comes in and they're just like, this is going to mess everything up. And they basically are trying to stop the law from being in effect. And what CBE and a bunch of our coalition partners are trying to do is to make sure that we keep this law, SB 1137. And if you go online, we actually have a website over the coalition, which is CaliforniaVersusBigOil.com. So CAVSBIGOIL.com. And I think you can join there to sign up to join that coalition. I mean, it's going to be a really big election year. And even just for local laws and state laws, I think this is really important to let big oil like not just do whatever they want to do, and that actually living next to oil drilling sites is harmful to your health and no one should have to deal with that.
Wow. Amazing. And see, aren't you glad that KPFK doesn't take money from big oil so we can shout it from the mountaintop? Look at CAVersusBigOil.com and join the fight against big oil. Woohoo. Okay, Domus.
Yeah. And you can learn more about Just Solutions at justsolutionscollective.org. I am going to go look up CA versus big oil right now.
That is wonderful. Well, thank you so much to both of you, Jen Ganada, Edalmas Vaquero, for being with us today. Environmental justice is one of my favorite subjects, and I'm just feeling very inspired by having people like both of you working on it in your day-to-day life. So thank you. I can't wait to have you both back on again. And yes, now I'm going back to pitching, because KPFK, we need KPFK, but the both of you can sign off. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. But yes, for listeners, you can't sign off yet, because I'm going to remind you that one last time that it's KPFK's summer fun drive. And if you enjoyed hearing the great conversations today, if you want to support independent news, independent voices, diverse perspectives, please take a minute right now to give something back, $5, $20, whatever you can give. You can go on kpfk.org or you can give us a call at 818-985-5735. And be sure to let them know that that you're a fan of the Lawyers Guild show, because we do get some brownie points. You know, we don't get a commission or anything, but, you know, we get pats on the back, and that's what we live for. So, so please do let them know that. And yes, as I mentioned, it's KPFK's 65th birthday this year. So, you know, KPFK over those generations, over, you know, the 1960s, the 70s, 80s, all of the different issues we've been going through in the 2000s, KPFK has been there to be our tracking voices, our diverse perspectives. And it's all curated and brought to you on this one free place, no subscription fee like other platforms. And as we've said, KPFK doesn't take the big corporate donations. So we've got you and I, we've got to pitch in to help with that shoestring budget. And that is how we continue to speak truth to power and celebrate various viewpoints and cultures when other dominant discourse and dominant news stations and big money power out there are trying to stifle. They're trying to censor diverse viewpoints and cultures. So that's why we have to keep our station free, whatever you can afford. Also, if you go on the website, there are these little thank you gifts that maybe you'll want to pick out for yourself. I know that's not why you give, but you know, you can get a KPFK bumper sticker or tote bag. There's books, CDs, DVDs. And of course, you can become a full-fledged voting member of KPFK with a donation of just $25. Then you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on with the station and advance notice of the great programming. And maybe you want to volunteer and run for the local listener station board. You know, we're always looking for volunteers for that. And yeah, it's the way to stay connected. As we heard from Attorney Anthony Cornerans, you know, as we all are aging, that means our community is more important to us and to others than ever before. So by pitching in and becoming a member of KPFK, you'll be contributing and you'll be serving our collective community and the causes of free speech, cultural expression, peace, and justice. So yes, let's do that now. Let's, you know, get ready for it. It's a big historic election year. You know, whoever wins, we're still being stifled and we've got to keep fighting for free speech, which continues to be under attack. And looking at history, we've learned that the only way to push back against attempts to quiet or silence us is to turn up that volume, insist on your rights to speak your mind, and insist on your right to listen to who you want to listen to. And you can do that right now by supporting KPFK. So, yes, it's about time for me to wrap up, but just know that, you know, I appreciate you. KPFK appreciates you. And I definitely want to thank our guests today, attorneys Anthony Cornerans, Jen Ganada, and Dalmas Vaquero, as well as Bordoff, D'Angelo Jones, and my co-host Jim Lafferty, who's out traveling the world, but he'll be back later this summer, rest assured, and everyone else out there listening. Until next week, this is Maria Hall with the Lawyers Guild Show. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. No, you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that bitter is cold after story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Hi this is singer-songwriter Nancy Sanchez inviting you to tune in every Saturday night at 10 p.m. right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles to listen to the best Latinx alternative show on the coolest radio station powered by the people, La Gente. See you this Saturday at 10 p.m. on Travel Tips for Aztlan. Nos vemos.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. Make your tax-deductible donation to kpfk.org today. Membership has privilege.